This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey folks, Jeff is out this week. So in lieu of a new show, we are marking a celebration of the upcoming start of baseball season on the 28th with a rerun of our Book Nerd Movie Hour episode about Shoeless Joe by W.P. Kinsella and the movie Field of Dreams that is based on the novel. If you've been listening for a while, you know that Jeff and I share a love of baseball and a really deep love of Field of Dreams. This was a fun conversation. We're happy to revisit it. Hope you'll enjoy it, and we'll be back in your ears with the news on Monday.
Welcome to Book Ride Podcast. Today, we are talking about The Dream Field. Field of Dreams, the 1989 movie and the 1983 novella. Was that? 1982 novella called Shoeless Joe by W.P. Kinsella, upon which the movie is based. We're going to do what we do. We haven't done these in a while where we read the book, watch the movie, and talk about them together. You know what's interesting? I haven't really thought about, you know, sort of the meta commentary about why we choose the movies we choose or the books we choose to do outside the ones that we like. We haven't yet chosen a one where we know the book is superior somehow. We haven't looked at a failed adaptation. We start with successful movies because we're really talking about the movies here as much as anything, right? Because it's Book Nerd Movie Club is how we think about it. The movie is more the central thing. You could choose, say, Great Gatsby and choose either the Robert Redford adaptation or the Baz Luhrmann one, both of which aren't terrible, but I don't think they have a lot of affinity in our hearts or the wider world.
Right.
Where these movies, the movies are the locus, the gravitational center of why we choose these. And it so happens that sometimes the books are pretty good. They range from pretty good to very good, or very, you know, in the case of like The Princess Bride, where everything you see in the movie is really in the book and really just some stuff is left out, to Jurassic Park or Hunt for October, where a lot of what you like is there, but there's some interesting additions and subtractions, some clarifying things that happen.
Yeah, along with that, it's like we need to have affection for at least one of the things between the book or the movie, and then the sense that the other one is not awful. Yeah, we haven't done anywhere we've loved the movie and the book was just bad.
No, that's right. And like the Da Vinci Code, which we started off, I think we have sort of equal affections in a way for the, or different kind of. The lever is much more equal to talk about them there. The difference here is this is our first time, I think, when our affections are so disproportionate for the movie than the book. And I have to admit, we will get into this.
Yeah.
My book reading memory of it is way different. I read it, I was like 13. So I read it when I was, you know, a much younger person. And so I didn't read with the same eyes and I just don't remember.
Yeah.
I remember liking it okay.
Okay.
I did not like it okay this
time. Well, and yeah, when you were 13, that was before your insufferable literary nerd phase.
I was more of a baseball fan than a
All
book
right.
fan at
okay.
that point. And there's a lot more baseball yes, in the novella, so I can see now why I liked it.
That
frankly.
Makes sense. That makes sense that if you were reading this as a baseball fan and it's a baseball mm-hmm. book, I can see some affection there. If I have to, I will be very honest that if I did not have to read the whole book as part of being able to do this, I probably would not have finished the book.
And that's even knowing that it's not very long. Yeah. I mean, you didn't have a lot to slog through and still wouldn't have done the slogging. I think we're going to do our first sponsor break now. And then the next thing we're going to talk about is our pre-existing relationship with Field of Dreams and then how a second viewing, you know, how we've come to it now. What do we see with our adult eyes, but we'll do that right after a quick sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate, high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode.
I have to ask you before we keep going, I read a 260-page book. What did you read?
Oh, I guess that's about what I was... I mean, it's not 450 pages.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just
okay.
saying it's not that long. It's,
okay.
It's
yeah, I was like,
long.
Is that a novella? We don't need to argue about the length of a novella now.
No. I guess I also did it on Kindle, which can be deceiving. If you fly through it, you're like, that was a short book. But
yeah, okay. Because I
much
think
time
there maybe
otherwise.
Was a short story version at some point, and I just
yes,
had a moment of panic of like, oh God, are we not actually talking about the same thing?
No, we're talking about the same thing. All right, let's talk about the movie. So it came out in 1989. I think we've talked about this either together in the post show, on the show, I don't remember, but a super important movie for me at a really interesting time in my own life. I was 11 years old, riding my bike around in the summer of 89 when it came out. We would ride our bikes up to the Hillcrest movie theater and you could go see movies for cheap during the day. I think it was a buck. You could go in on a Tuesday afternoon and see a movie. So in Kansas in August, which is basically southern Iowa, northeastern Kansas, essentially. So it was like going to see a movie about a place you're from, about a sport you like. And it was air conditioned and you could do it by yourself. You know, I get my quarter pound of Runtz, no bananas from the pharmacy on the corner where the guy would jimmy around the banana Runtz to give me my quarter pound, sneak it into Hillcrest. And my brother and I would watch, I think we watched Field of Dreams four or five times that summer. And that doesn't include the twice I went with my dad, who in 1989 was 37 years old, which is exactly the same age as Ray Kinsella. And my dad's own relationship with his father is not like this one, but it was fraught. Wow. And my grandfather was dead at this point. He had died 2 years before this movie came out.
Have you and your dad talked about his experience of this?
Rebecca, we're from the Midwest. What do you think?
Look, I had to ask.
I know. We both like the movie. And I think, so it's very, very, very close to my heart. In a way, I can't even talk about it. I mean, there's no objectivity, blah, blah, blah. But like, you don't want to talk to me. Even my scholarly eyes, which I sometimes like to put on, that's not what I'm doing here. Like, I can do a little bit of it, but this is a movie that was like super, super formative to me in a lot of ways. And it's been very important since. And I have very great fondness for it. Rebecca, talk to me about your early experience.
Yeah. You know, I texted my dad this week and asked him if he remembered the first time that he saw a Field of Dreams, and he said he doesn't remember, but he assumes that he went to see it at the theater, or that he and my mom would have gone to see it together or something. I was seven when it came out in 1989. I don't know when I first saw it. I think it would either have been borderline to be seven.
You could have gone, but you also could have not at that point.
All my memories of it are from watching it in our family's living room on TV. Mm. And so I think I must have seen it either, when we were able to rent the VHS at Blockbuster, or when it aired on cable. Well, I do know that when it aired on cable, at some point we recorded it. And back in that day, it was, you recorded and then you pressed pause on the recording whenever commercials were on TV so that you could, try to splice it together. And then I watched this just repeatedly through my childhood. And this, watching it with the lens of, we're going to talk about it on the show and I'm trying to take notes and think about it. This is the first time I've tried to subject my affection for it to any kind of scrutiny. And it is also not something that I want to put deeply under the lens. There's just it's a very magical movie. Mm-hmm. I just feel very connected to it. And I cannot really remember a time in my life that this wasn't a touchstone piece of media for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess bigger picture things too for the movie that I was wondering about. Was there a movie before that hung quite so bright a lantern on the father's and son's relationship are screwed up, but it doesn't have to be? Do you know what I'm getting at? Like, there's a lot of like, my dad was a jerk, or we didn't get along, or he was tough on me or whatever. But this doesn't only deal with that, but it also suggests one of the magical pieces of it is that it doesn't have to be that way.
Right.
You don't need a magical cornfield, but this is something we want to ameliorate. This is something we want to change writ large, that like these dynamics are toxic and they don't do anybody any good. And almost like a different kind of sensibility to understanding parent-child relationships. Almost the birth of kind of a new parenting.
Yeah,
you look at how Costner looks at his daughter in the movie, he's actively trying to break patterns, right? Like he's thinking about what kind of parent he wants to be. And I've talked with some of my friends that are of my age, and I think it hadn't quite penetrated the public consciousness yet that a lot of us of my age who have kids actively think about being good parents and what that, and I think a lot of people think about that, but it's not just about what I want my kids to be, but how to maximize for their happiness, which, weird to say, is a relatively recent invention in parenting.
It is.
To think about this.
It is.
And I think this is a transitional kind of a document, right?
I'd never considered that, but I think you're right. And one that comes after it that does a similar thing, there's a similar kind of relationship repair in a son understanding his father in a new way in Big Fish.
Yes, yes, that's a great example. A scion of mm-hmm. this kind of thinking of how to understand. And it happens with mothers in different contexts too, of understanding your mothers and grandparents and things like this. But like, this is one where it's looking for a way to articulate the pain of the schism and then what goes on to it. And like, almost, I mean, the metaphorical reading is that the universe has to reinvent itself for fathers and sons to get along. Right. It's basically what the movie is sort of arguing. But I think we'll talk about this a little bit too, that the strong reaction that many, especially men had, especially white Protestant men, I think that's fair to say, mm-hmm. Is because they hadn't seen this before, right? It wasn't just that this is a story about Shoeless Joe walking out of a cornfield magically. It's what the emotional core of the movie is, and frankly is the thing that makes the movie resonant in a way that the book just isn't for a lot of reasons we can get into.
I think it's powerful because it's not about magically changing the past. It's not about, you're right, your dad was a jerk, he should have been a different person. The healing that happens, like on the page or on the screen here, is the perspective that Kevin yes. Costner gets about his father of, oh, I get to see him at a time in his life where there was still like life in his eyes, when he hadn't been worn down by the world yet. And to realize as an adult that your parent is a person, mm-hmm. you know, is a really significant thing. But then to go the extra step of, your parent is a person, and how did their experience of just being a person in the world shape your experience of them as a parent? And I think that like adds a kind of compassion that is essential, and also is not easily, it's not made easily available to men in culture or media.
No. And this one also, he doesn't actually have to grapple directly with his father, mm-hmm, right? Like, his right. dad isn't alive sort of in Florida, still being a cantankerous mess, and he has to go down there. So there is the useful fantasy distance that allows a kind of, I don't know, some sort of work to be done that would be more difficult if it was actually his, I guess at this point, 70-year-old father. Mm-hmm. Sitting, actually, his father was really old, actually, the way this thing actually, if you do the time right. of how old John Kinsella actually would have been here, I think he would have been in his mid-80s or something like that, even though Ray was still only 37 at the time of the book. So that's one thing that really struck me as a new thing in sort of a content kind of a way. Also, we're in the middle, we're coming actually to the end of a great run of baseball movies. And as quiet as kept, this is really a baseball movie. Yeah. It's not a sports movie. There's some baseball in it, but it's very baseball back of the palette. But Costner almost didn't do the movie because he had just been in maybe the best baseball movie, maybe the best sports movie of all time in Bull Durham, which is also a baseball movie, completely different and very literary in its own way. I mean, Susan Sarandon doing a little light BDSM while reciting Whitman. Who doesn't want to sign up for that? And then, you know, also The Natural was a few years before that. So we get this run of The Natural and Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, and then a few years later you get League of Their Own, which I think mm-hmm. those four, take your pick, you're looking at the four best baseball movies. Yeah. Eight Men Out comes out a little bit before this, yeah. which is about the 1919 Black Sox scandal. A pretty good movie with John Cusack playing Shoeless Joe, the lead there, weirdly a very different look than Ray Liotta, which we can talk about some more. But like, this is the height of baseball as, I don't know, a movie kind of a trope that's looking at baseball from a few different ways, not sort of a standard sports movie. And then we're not quite at the apotheosis of Costner. I don't think that comes until Bodyguard in 1991, where like mm-hmm. that's the biggest movie in the world and the biggest song in the world, and he's next to Whitney Houston and sort of holding his own. But he's on his way to being the bodyguard. But this really crystallizes what Costner is good at. And what he tries in some other places shows what he's not good at and who he doesn't become. So I know Kevin Costner is very important to you. So that's what we're gonna talk about, casting writ large. But where we are this was a giant hit. It remains, often comes at the top list of the best baseball movie, of sports movies of all time. Which, again, it does have sports in it, but I don't think it's a sports movie. It's not about sports.
It's not about sports. It's not about like the meaning of sport, you know, writ large. It's one of the notes that I had was, the book is a baseball book that has a father and son story. And I think the reason the movie works, and we will, a large part of this podcast episode is going to be just an ode to Phil Alden Robinson,
and who adapted this hagiography of St. Robinson.
Right.
The God of adapting.
What a genius. Like, a genius. Truly a work of art that he, what he did adapting this from the book. But he turned a book about baseball into a movie that's about fathers and sons. And it just uses baseball as a very effective frame. And I think that's why this is so widely appealing, that you don't have to be, I think you probably have to be a baseball person to like really love the book Shoeless Joe by W.P. Kinsella. You need not be a baseball person to relate to Field of Dreams.
The other thing that's interesting, think about where kind of the movie world we're in right now, or then in the late 80s, like Batman had just come out as well in 89. So we had Superman in 1977. So the nature of the blockbuster was a completely different thing. It was a lot of buddy cop stuff, right? You know, we're doing Lethal Weapon 2, we're doing Die Hards, we're doing Terminators. And that's the action blockbustery thing, but there was still room for dramas to be a blockbuster. If this is made now, well, I had this for the end, but like this does not gross what it grossed at the box office in 1989 for a whole bunch of reasons.
Yeah.
One is it's pretty slow. I mean, there's it's starring Kevin Costner, and the second leading star is Korn.
I think it's a really tough hang. I think if it's made now, it's like Focus Features. You know, it's a smaller...
I don't even know what that looks like at this point.
It's a much smaller deal, or someone would have tried to make it, you know, as they always ask at the end of the Rewatchables podcast, which we both enjoy quite a bit, could this have been a 10-episode Netflix series? And somebody probably would have tried.
Or a 4-episode or a limited edition.
Yeah.
It really could have been. I think it, for me, again, you always have to situate these places in time. Just about of a perfect movie as you're going to get. But it does fall into this nice little 1985 to like 1990-ish what if trend in blockbusters that was Back to the Future, Field of Dreams, and Big with Tom Hanks. All of these are a little bit what if time travel is real. Actually, Big is a really interesting corollary
that
to Field of Dreams.
I haven't thought about that, but you're right.
Because it doesn't explain the magic. You know, it's a very simple kind of a situation. It's about being a kid, but also being a son and also being an adult all at the same time. So that collapsing and telescoping of fathers and sons and daughters or mothers is a little bit different there. But this idea of you could have a $200 million star-making role, which doesn't really need any special effects. Like the biggest special effects here is like a little translucency filter when like Shoeless Joe is walking into the corn. Like that was kind of it. Interesting to see what this would have been if it's done now. I think the other thing, that if this was done now, the valence of who gets to come back and why is completely different. I think these are Negro Leaguers. This is Satchel Paige saying, you know, I never got to show my stuff in the big leagues. And I always wanted to throw against Ruth or something like that and see what was I really made of. That's completely different here. But in the Costner realm, I think he's the perfect person for it. I wouldn't recast him at all. But you see why this is not a good role for, say, well, his running buddy in Bull Durham. Tim Robbins probably could have done it. You could see kind of a similar vibe he's thrown in Shawshank. But he's a little too tall. He's a little too... There's something non-threatening about Costner that is really important for the Costner thing. And it's why it doesn't work in The Postman. It's why look at Dances with Wolves right now, an extremely tough hang from 1990 to watch these days. You look at Waterworld, you look at The Postman. He's not an action hero.
He's not.
Costner doing Costner at his very best. Can you say, tell me why I am right about Costner? This is his groove. This is his place. This is where you want Costner. What are we getting from him that's so him and so important to this
There movie? Is this like emotional availability, I think, that makes him a great actor and also non-threatening and also then not great at the action hero situation.
He's not going to kick your ass.
Yeah.
He's just not going to.
He is. Yeah. He's just not going to. And I think it's just a wonderful, he has a wonderful way of harnessing that. Like in the 2021 slang, like if Costner were 37 today, we'd be talking about the characters he could play as like, he's a wife guy, you know, like he's good at conveying warmth and affection and sort of a depth of care with a few lines. And, you know, again, Phil Alden Robinson did magic with this script. And there are some beautiful lines in the book that do make their way into the script. So W.P. Kinsella, like that, the source material is strong there too. But this is just the right zone for Costner. You know, like he wouldn't have been a teenage heartthrob either. Like, I don't think you can swap out like a shirtless Matthew McConaughey at 25 for a shirtless Kevin Costner in something and get it.
No.
Like, this was just this was the good Kevin Costner zone was like, let me take care of you. Let's look at our stuff together.
Right. He in a lot of ways is one of the great dad vibe actors of all time.
Yes.
Like even more than my beloved Hanks, our beloved Hanks, Hanks has he has more of an edge than Costner does. He's funnier. I think he reads as smarter on, this is not fair. I don't know relative IQ. I don't care. But Hanks, you look at Hanks in Philadelphia and he plays a really smart, sharp, vulnerable lawyer who is smarter and outmaneuvering you. Mm-hmm. But then he also plays an 11-year-old in a 30-year-old's body in Big with some of the great physical comedy acting you're ever going to see. But then he also does, you know, he does all the things that Tom Hanks can do, just much different. He does Forrest Gump, say what you will about that, but it was, you know, Tom Hanks can do something like that. Costner can't do any of those
things. Comparing anybody to Tom Hanks's range is pretty unfair.
but even so, I mean, you look at, like, say, a Jeff Bridges, who's a similar age, right, who has a different vibe, but he's not going to, he could maybe play this, but he can't play Big. But could he play, you know, he's not, Costner is sexy, but he's not Pitt or Clooney. He's vulnerable without being, I don't know, kind of a pushover. He's earnest, you know, without being naive, and he's smart without being threatening. He's just kind of good for all time zones.
Yeah, it's the like kind of archetypal men want to be him, women want to be with him, sort of.
Do men want to be Ray Kinsella? I'm not sure about that.
Maybe not Ray Kinsella, but I think a lot of men did want to be Kevin Costner.
I don't know. I'm not sure. Who was I looking at in like 1991 going? I guess we went through the anti-pattern, which is the other end of the spectrum. You're looking at Arnold or Sly, right? You're looking at or Bruce Willis, which... Those guys are the appeal. I think men wanted to be those guys when it comes to actors. I don't think they wanted to be Costner.
Something really powerful about a person who is clearly like not trying too hard, and Costner had that. Really, really had that.
That's something that he makes it look so easy.
He makes it look easy. And I just like early 2 hours ago while I was eating lunch, I was watching an interview that Phil Alden Robinson did in 2013, like a great 45-minute interview called Page to Screen. We'll drop the link in the show notes.
Where I didn't watch that. I'm going to watch it. I'm fascinated by this Phil Alden Robinson story.
Oh my gosh, where he's talking about the process. But, you know, as you just said, they almost didn't ask Costner to be in this because he had just been in Bull Durham. And apparently at the time it was like believed in the industry that a baseball movie was just not a great call. So like, why would someone like Kevin Costner do two baseball movies in a row? But Costner apparently is a very good baseball player. And
he also plays For the Love of the Game later as a pitcher and very credible as a pitcher.
Right. And you can see it in Bull Durham that he is actually quite good and knows what he's doing. And he had to dial it back for the scenes where he's actually doing baseball things. In Field of Dreams. So apparently like he can really pitch, but what he said to Robinson was like, man, I've got to throw like I'm a duck out here so that he could pitch in a way that Ray Liotta could hit for that scene when he's pitching to Shoeless Joe the first time. And Robinson talked about, you know, going up to him at the end of the day of shooting and saying, I saw some like real humility on display in your acting today. And Costner saying, thanks for noticing. Cause like, man, it was killing me that I couldn't really show everything that I've got. But I think it's such a smart choice for an actor to know when the best thing you can do is not go all the way to 11 and not show the full range that you have. And it made him this relatable everyman kind of, it makes him this relatable everyman that is part of what makes the movie work also.
It made me wonder, let's say you're remaking this movie beat for beat today, and you're not doing gender or race bending, which I think you would make it more interesting. It would add a valence today that it wouldn't have had back then. Is Matt Damon Ray Kinsella? Like, who's our Costner now?
Oh,
like, he's dad, right? It's not Hanks. He's a little too old at this point.
I mean, Matt Damon's even a little too old at this point.
He's a little too old. Is it Gosling?
Maybe.
A little too good looking? A little too smooth?
Yeah, we don't have not that Kevin Costner is average looking, because I could, I have a thesis on that. Stay tuned.
John Hamm, a little old, but maybe you could do a different version of Hamm.
Who has good dad?
Again, he's too big. After Draper, you can't see Hamm.
I think
I'm mucking around with corn. Like, it just seems you're not going to see it.
Yeah. Bryan Cranston 10 years ago.
Yeah, I'm not as up as on my, who's even 30? People are much older now, because it's like you're looking at your Gyllenhaals are even in their 40s, right? Like, you need, you're going back a couple years even before then. But this kind of movie, it's so contemplative for so much of it.
Is it like a younger Hemsworth?
Too good looking.
Yeah.
Or not too good, he's too brawny, right? Like, Costner's good looking, but he's not like lifting weights all the time. But all leading men now, since they have to be in a Marvel movie at one point, like Ruffalo. Like, maybe Ruffalo is interesting.
Oh, Ruffalo is interesting.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't look, he looks like, he's like a New Yorker, right? He's like an Italian. Like, Costner is a Midwest. He looks like a Midwest.
Right.
Do you know where Costner's from?
I don't know.
He could be from Indiana, from all I know.
Yeah. But
he looks like a Midwest.
Yeah. I think you need that, like, dad energy thing. And Ruffalo has that.
Right. So from there, what works about the movie? So Costner, clearly the acting, he does. I'm not sure Costner's a great actor. He's great at being Kevin Costner dad figures. Like, when he tries to do a JFK or a Boston accent in JFK or other movies, like, or not JFK, 13 Days, very tough. But if he's given the chance to do Costner things, like, now he's the main actress's dad in movies. Like, when Molly's Game or some other thing, he shows up like, oh, right, dad, Kevin Costner's here. Everyone believes, and he does that thing of being warm and vulnerable, but not a pushover at the same time. What works about the movie? I guess the important thing is that the idea of it, and this is, you know, Phil Alden Robinson kept big structural pieces, but then moved some things and then got rid of some stuff. This idea of a cornfield turned into a baseball field that brings back baseball players is a really strange and cool idea.
It is.
It just is. It's a really strange and cool
idea. And that the bringing back of the baseball players is just a vehicle for the bringing back of Ray's dad, which I think, as you just alluded to, is the thing that really makes the movie work. That in the book, we get the mention of Ray's dad, like, on page 2, and you know that that's sort of what the whole thing is driving at. And the movie really saves that reveal for the end, that we're really doing this. The he, and if you build it, he will come, is Ray's dad. And that we're really saving that reveal for that final moment. And hey, dad, want to have a catch? Like, that's the biggest change, I think, that makes it work. And not giving away not explaining the magic. You know, they don't explain the magic in the book. And I think it was really smart to not explain the magic of the movie. I noticed when I got it on demand on my cable service that it's classified as fantasy. And I was like, well, that's interesting. Because, of course, there's like, this is about bringing back dead baseball players by building a baseball field out in your corn. Of course, that's fantasy. But it's not how I had thought about the movie before. So that was,
I have thought about that too. Because, you know, we once had a really wide, I'd say, heated discussion about
legendary at this point
fantasy, the difference between fantasy and speculative fiction in person one time. Basically, speculative fiction is the big category of what if.
Yeah.
Something that is not true and really couldn't be true as far as we know. What if that were the case? So under that rubric, it is speculative. I think this is more of a fable, though. And I think that difference is important. Because if you think about it too hard, the whole thing comes crumbling down. So you cannot think about the mechanics of the ghost, the rationale of the field, what actually is going to happen when that line of cars shows up. Like, it ruins the whole thing immediately.
Yeah,
like, you have to take the end and the beginning of the movie as a snow globe universe and look at it for what it is. You cannot do the thing of like, well, it's like from an M. Night Shyamalan sort of a way where, like, does all the thing really connect together in a way that makes complete sense and it's tied up with there are loopholes and plot holes and things that are, that doesn't matter, because you know what? It makes emotional sense within the rules it's established, and it just works. Don't think about it too hard.
It makes emotional sense, and it's better to not ask the questions in this case. And I think all the things that really make the movie work are choices that Robinson made about what to leave out from the book. There's the only thing, and that he really builds the relationship between Ray and Annie and writes in the book banning thing, which that was a big surprise to me, was that the whole like plot where they go to the PTA meeting and Annie gets to call a woman a book burning Nazi cow, which is just one of the great insults of cinematic history.
Amy Madigan, I mean, the Annie role that Robinson wrote is great, and she brings just a wonderful energy that is so needed in the book. It's a nothing role. It's a walkover. It's a terrible part.
That
it's
Robinson, I read a, I went, you know, way down the internet rabbit hole in prep for this, and I read an interview with Robinson where he said that he really latched on to the way that Annie is written in the book and wanted to see more of that kind of wife on screen. Like in the book, there's a lot of, Ray has a lot of affection for Annie and spends a lot of time talking about how he can't wait to like get home and hold her at night. And I would just like to take this moment to personally object to like phrases about awake in the middle of the night loving Annie, because I don't ever need to read those again.
That's not something
you WP Kinsella's sex writing is not a thing that anyone needs to experience.
Frankly, I'd be happy if there were no sex writing ever, but that's my particular opinion. But we've established that I'm a reading prude when it comes to those sorts of things.
And but she is like Ray, and hears the voice one time in the book and comes inside and is like, I heard this voice and I think I need to build a baseball field. And Annie's just game. And that and that Robinson picks up on how game she is and then draws out this thread of like, this is a very sort of 60s way of approaching things. And what if I give them this backstory? And the movie opens with that. You know, in college, I majored in English, but really I majored in the 60s.
Unbelievable cold open.
An
unbelievable cold open. It tells us everything we need to know without telling us too much. And since you're not in the movie itself, it doesn't, like, it's the most literal exposition in the world. Like, you're reading, like, the abstract of the article before you're getting to it, but it's fun. Like,
it's
a fun little story in itself, and a miracle in its own way.
You know, the book doesn't have Terrence Mann. The book has J.D. Salinger, and Ray gets the message that he's got to go kidnap J.D. Salinger. In fact, before it was called Shoeless Joe, the book was called The Kidnapping of J.D. Salinger. Like, the history of titling of these properties is kind of bonkers.
Very interesting.
And not only did J.D. Salinger object to this sentimental presentation of himself, but I think it was distracting from the story to have people try to imagine or believe an actor on screen playing J.D. Salinger, who looms so large in popular imagination precisely because he's such a recluse, that he just, Robinson was like, okay, what if instead we imagine this other, what other kind of writer would have been formative to Ray and Annie particularly, and let's make him the guy who invented the phrase of make love, not war. And I just want to see James Earl Jones do this thing. So let's kind of write it with him in mind.
Yeah, I think that's when we get to the movie in terms of what makes it so special. I think Costner's a necessary but not sufficient. Like, there's a lot of there's a lot of things that go, but that we buy the magic of the field and the way they shoot it at dusk, the way they shoot it at dawn, the way the players, you know, Joe comes out initially at night under the lights, that we buy, as silly as it sounds, that somehow the movie gets us to buy that this is a real thing, and how delicate the touch is. It's hard to imagine watching it for the first time. I watched it with my kids who had never seen it before. They enjoyed it. They thought the voice was creepy, which when you think about it, the cornfield has now become a place of terror in popular culture, right? Like, that's like you go out, it's like Children of the Corn sort of a situation, where if you've been to the Midwest, if you've been to really farms of any kind at this time of year, you know, it's kind of early, late summer. It's not ready to harvest, but the corn is up. And that coolness of the morning and the coolness of the evening where it's still hot, and the sun is gorgeous, and it feels like the world is an open bloom, an open flower at those moments. It sets us up for a kind of readiness to believe, I think, that there is magic of it its own kind, and things can happen there. And the cinematography is just unbelievably great. But the deftness and the slowness and the confidence to say, we don't have to explain this, we're going to let it happen. I think Robinson does a couple of nice things where nice in terms of dialogue, but also Costner being Costner, there's another version of this movie where is he just nuts? Like, we don't believe for a second that this is a manic episode or some sort of psychotic break or something like that. In 1989, we also didn't use that language in quite the way we have used now, but like, we believe it's real from the moment we hear the voice and he sees the, you know, the field in the distance. Everything else is just, how is he going to convince himself and how is he going to make it happen? So that we feel like we're in safe hands from the beginning really matters in a way I hadn't really ever, I hadn't really ever come to grips with before, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And to him being necessary but not sufficient, I think the casting in general is just
unbelievable,
stellar. And the chemistry between the cast is stellar. Timothy Busfield as Annie's brother Mark, who in the book that character looms a lot larger as this like evil guy who's trying to take over the farm, is also just wonderful. And we know from the book that Annie's family are very religious and very judgmental, and this comes up a lot. And there's like one reference to it, maybe.
It's all you need.
In the script.
You need in the movie, there's the one thing.
And then the wardrobe does a ton of work there. There's the, so the scene where they're having dinner, and Annie's mom and I presume Annie's sister are dressed like character, like extras from Little House on the Prairie. And
her mom is wearing cat eye glasses from the 50s still, 30 years later. Right. She hasn't updated her.
And it's like, okay, eyewear. They don't need to say anything, we know what these people are about. And then, you know, James Earl Jones is wonderful. I have never made it through this film without just dying laughing, and I'm gonna beat you with a crowbar and make you go away.
I'm gonna beat you to death with a crowbar
and make you go away. And Robinson writes in so much.
My God, you're from the 60s.
You told me your finger was a gun. Like, there's so much humor in the script too that doesn't come across, that, or that at least to me didn't come across in the book. Like that great moment when Costner and James Earl Jones get to the ballpark and they're like standing at the concession stand, and Costner has just asked him like, well, what do you do with your time? And he's like, well, I work and I take walks and I watch sunsets. And Costner's like, well, what do you want? And James Earl Jones starts spouting off like kind of philosophical. He's like, no, like, do you want a hot, like, what do you want? Like a hot dog and a beer? Like, no, but not what you want in life. But the movie moves so well between those two levels of that, like the big existential questions of this book, and then also really small, intimate moments of humor.
I think it took me reading the book to see that the Salinger piece, it's not bad in the book. It just doesn't work in the same way because we have no prior about who Salinger is. Mm-hmm. So there's this recluse who the one thing people know about him is a recluse, is going to go off with this guy to a ballpark. And the same thing happens in the movie, but the difference is Jones plays it. I think Jones, that moment where he goes from absolute sort of distaste for Ray and all that he represents to genuinely being interested is a really important thing that I didn't buy in the book, because it doesn't make any sense logically. Like,
yeah.
There's no way this guy, there's no way Terrence Mann is going to, knowing what we know about Terrence Mann at this point, is going to go to a ball field with Ray unless Jones can get us to believe that he still got a little sparkle in his eye about being curious about the world, right? And whatever the magic is supposed to be doing for Terrence Mann, and the Salinger thing is similar in the book, it's supposed to be reintegrating him into the world to sort of rescue him from fear, isolation, being under assault from culture, from the world, so that he can be his best self and do what he was born to do. And in both cases, it's you're going to go away from the things of man to explore and do story, but you're not going to be subject to the harassment and like being famous and all that sort of things. But what Jones does, since we don't know who Terrence Mann is, we don't have any preconceived notion, so we can fill him with this wonderful modulation from anger to magic to belief to skepticism, to humor, to real pathos and a real understanding. And again, when I'm in 1989, James Earl Jones, that's Darth Vader.
Right.
Like, and I think, you know, Jones is probably, we've probably missed most of Jones's best performances because they're all on the stage, I think, is one thing that's known. But he's, again, a lot of great movies. But in this, when he's in his apartment and Ray is there, Jones just acts circles around him. And again, it's part of Costner being subject to Jones and whatever and being nervous. But you see what James Earl, the power and the mirth all coming together in a really magical way. And it really powers, I think, Mann and Jones power the back half of the movie. Because once Ray build the ball field, there's not a lot left for him to do, honestly, at that point.
Yeah,
the rest is sort of Man and Moonlight Graham, which is its own kind of magic.
Right, and that
part is really important.
The people will come, Ray. You know, it's money they have and peace they lack. That whole speech, which apparently James Earl Jones did not think would make it into the final cut. Like, that's a right. He says, you know, he loves filming it, but on the day that they're filming it, he is like telling Phil Alden Robinson, "I know this isn't going to make it. Like, how can it not make it? How can you film this movie?"
I can understand that, though. You're in the middle of Iowa on a set, and it's the middle of summer, and you're doing like this almost Shakespearean monologue.
I mean,
Karen.
I think the whole like, no,
it filming, just doesn't seem plausible.
Filming this had to feel like a fever dream,
right?
You know,
right.
And when Terrence Mann turns around and has like decided he is going to go back into the cornfield with the players and find out whatever's on the other side, the rapture of Terrence Mann, if you will, from that final section of the book, James Earl Jones gives this like great big smile. And then there's this little giggle and this twinkle in his eye. And
he sort of paws at the corn, right? Yeah. He kind of sticks one hand out to sort of...
And like cracks up just a little... And there's so much going on. He's like, he just gives such good face, and there's so much going on in those like tiny gestures and these like small little sounds that he's letting out. That there's also something very compelling, I think, about an actor of his stature, both talent-wise and like literal physical stature, being able to convey like delicate and soft emotions in that place of like, watch me giggle while I walk into this corn, and being able to access that childlike wonder that I think is really at the heart of like the second heart of this story after you do the fathers and sons stuff is about openness to magic and openness to wonder and how those things are transformative. And either they bring people back to life or they take you to see something about life that you've never seen before. And Terrence Mann gets both of those. He gets to come back to the world and then he gets to go off to the magic place. And for somebody who, you know, looks and sounds the way that James Earl Jones looks and sounds, to be able to execute that is just... like one of those things where he makes it look so easy, but it's it's all these like small things that add up to so much.
I think his wardrobe does a lot of work too, because he's sort of like both, he has sort of a scholarly craftsman vibe going on, because you know he's a writer and clearly a literary genius, but also he can write code, and he's wearing his page boy hat, and he's got a lot of Cardis going on, like he's kind of a timeless of attire of in himself, but like the warmth he gives, the one that struck me is when he's interviewing people about Moonlight Graham. And somehow Jones gets you to believe that Terrence Mann isn't just there to sort of figure out the mystery. He becomes interested in Moonlight Graham himself. Like he's genuinely interested in hearing what these people have to say about this small town doctor who died, 71, they said. He had died 18 years before in the timeline of the movie. And that man is still interested in the world, as you get a sense that he's actually, he's not happy where he is. Where Salinger in the book tells us he's happy, he couldn't be happier, he's happy. And you kind of believe it in the book. So like, what is Salinger doing makes less sense. But Jones being out in the world, or Jones as man being out in the world, and seeing a still desire to connect with people makes a lot of other stuff possible in the end. So in terms of the performances, Costner being Costner is super important, but I don't think you're ever going to be struck by, God, wasn't Costner great in that, other than saying, isn't Costner great? Does that make sense? Like, that's what you say. You say Costner is great, but you're like, wasn't Costner great in that? I think Jones, you say, is great in this. Madigan, you say, she brings a openness, but also an edge at the same time, which I'm not quite sure how she pulls off. Like, she's a wiry fire plug, you know, with red hair, which is a thing from the book as well, who then also... will be like, go do your thing, and I don't have to understand it. And then also, I'm worried about the farm, and I'm going to tell you that, and I'm going to be vulnerable, and like both things are happening at the same time. So often that role would be one or the other. It would be completely in, or you're like, God, she's just a nag the whole time.
Nag is the word that I was thinking of too, that I think that character written another way just becomes a nag. And the crackle of the relationship between Ray and Annie is so fun to watch, where he's kind of the straight man, even though he's currently the one having this wild experience. But they've got she gets some great jokes in where it's like, clearly this is the kind of relationship where she's got his number and you don't really get away with much, but not in a mean way.
What's
you know?
It got to do with baseball?
I love what's Terrence Mann got to do with baseball? And she's like, as a small boy, he had a bat named Rosebud.
God, a small boy had a bat named Rosebud. Yeah, that she's critical is not the right, skeptical. Like, she questions without prosecuting, I guess. Like, what is going on here is a really interesting trick. The other one that blows me away every time, and I've gotten older, what Burt Lancaster does with Moonlight Graham is amazing stuff.
It is.
It's amazing stuff what he does with Moonlight Graham there.
It is.
Plays the Moonlight Graham we encounter as an older man, I think just a year before he dies. I think this little segment is Kinsella at his best, too. Because if you take a piece that's most like what the book is like, it's the Moonlight Graham piece, and the character is very similar. A lot of the words, that great monologue, a lot of the great language that Moonlight has is sort of this erudite, homespun. Well, he's a country doctor. He's probably the best educated person in a small town, and he acts like
it. We don't get to hear from Ray's dad about reflecting on his life, but we get to hear Moonlight Graham talking about, you know, like, I didn't realize that was the only day. You don't usually realize what I'm paraphrasing, but like, you're not usually aware that you're having a pivotal experience while it's happening, you know? Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that was the only day. And this, like, also recognition that it would have been great to play in the big leagues and have a big career, but he's also just a man who wanted to be kind of have a simple, good life and be embedded in his community, and that the real loss would have been if he couldn't have been a doctor for 50 years.
If I only got to be a doctor for 5 minutes,
that kind of reflection, and that Ray sees Moonlight do that, I think is built into some of the processing that I assume Ray is doing off the page and off the screen about, like, if this is how Moonlight Graham is thinking about his life and his regrets or his lack thereof, like, how much of my understanding of my dad is real and how much of it is like assumption and projection. And that's all part of Ray rethinking, not his relationship with his dad, because his dad's dead and they don't get to have a relationship again, but rethinking his memory of him and how he's going to hold that going forward.
Yeah. It's interesting too, to think of, there's one way of reading, some of the, the kind of, grad school English stuff you do to a book like Crime and Punishment, is you see how a lot of the other characters are, Raskolnikov is the main character of Crime and Punishment, like sort of different versions of them, who if you dial up a lever, dial down a lever, you move thing. A lot of these are, Ray's story, John's story, Moonlight Graham's stories, Archie Graham's story, Terrence Mann's story, are all kind of versions of the same story, which is things didn't go as you thought they would or hoped they might, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't go according to plan. They didn't go according to dream. And then how do you respond with that? Well, Moonlight Graham found a calling, right? He found something to replace, substitute, where he could connect with other people and live out, as Aristotle says, to use your greatest skills for the greatest good. That is the definition of happiness. Terrence Mann wanted to tell stories, wanted to connect, but was overwhelmed with the world, right? It was just a tsunami of attention that was suffocating. And then Ray's own father was, it didn't go how I wanted. My wife dies and I just broke, right? I just kind of broke. And Ray is at this moment where he could go any number of different directions. Like, this is one thing that's a little less clear to me writ large, is like, Ray doesn't articulate his relationship with the father is his biggest problem very early in the movie. And so the weakest part of the writing for Robinson to me is that part where Kevin Costner says, I'm 37 years old and I'm worried I'm never going to do a crazy thing in my life. Right. That's his motivation. Is like, the point of this is to do something crazy. Like, that's the buying the red convertible, like, cliche of a sort of midlife crisis, but they're all asking, what is their life about? Is there a way to figure out what my life is about? Because the other thing Ray learns is that it's not the healing with his father that's important, is that when he turns then to look at Karen.
Right.
That's the thing that really changes, like, it's not about me. Like, that's, Moonlight Graham learns that, Terrence Mann learns that. John Kinsella never gets a chance to learn it. Like, the way to figure out what to make your life about is how to make it not about you. Because if you do that, and if you're disappointed, then the whole thing's ruined, mm-hmm. right? If your whole, my whole goal in life is to hit a double in the major leagues and it doesn't happen, well, then you're done. There's nowhere else to go. But Ray realizes that it's not about him. It's about this person and that person and how he can connect with other people. And it's one of the simplest things in Western literature, all this idea that Forrester said, just connect. It's as simple as that. Like, that's the thing. You don't even know how simple the thing you're looking for really is. And that catch at the end is a sort of mm-hmm. ultimate sort of mystical reconnection or forging connection that never existed there. But the idea of connection too, and that's why then the movie works, because then everyone's like connecting to the movie, right? The very thing the movie is about is what it does for people. And it's simple. It's not complicated. It's not controversial. It's timeless, maybe even a little naive. But God damn it, if it doesn't work, if it doesn't feel as true now as it did then.
It really does. And I think it works because so much of that gets to go unspoken, or at least be like yeah. just under what we hear in the film. That I hear the character saying, I'm worried that I'm never going to do a crazy thing in my life. Not as like, I want to go wild and get a red convertible and have a midlife crisis, but it's like, I'm afraid I'm never going to take a risk, which is really, I'm afraid I'm not open. Or I'm afraid I will be.
That's so weird though.
Closed.
I mean, the context of the book, it makes more sense. And in the context of the movie, they were at Berkeley and they've gone to live on a farm. Like, yeah. that then never made sense to me.
I think
you move to a farm from Berkeley. Of course you take
yeah.
a chance. That's
but
so
now
weird.
I'm 37 and I'm settling down, and like, he really yeah. likes the roots, but like, what if this means I'm closed? And like, he saw right. his father become closed off. Terrence Mann has become mm-hmm. closed off. In the book, there's the whole sideline with Eddie Sissons, who is maybe the most closed off of yeah. the characters, of the versions of these men that are on the page, and removing him from the movie is an interesting choice, but he's so closed off, and he's created that by like making his whole life be a lie about this experience that he never actually had about playing for the Cubs, and has been disconnected from family and disconnected from community. And I think that's the thing that Ray is afraid of, is like, will the cynicism kick in? You know, like, am I yeah. going to be closed off? And you can't make that discovery that life is really only good and meaningful when it's about other people if you are remaining closed off. And that's the trap that Terrence Mann has been in of,
yes,
it was overwhelming. I did this thing. I put my work out into the world. The response was overwhelming. So I got to go into the cocoon. But then when you're in the cocoon, that's a very trapped and closed off feeling that lacks connection. And there's this sparkle that brings him back out. He does hunger for it. I think we all do. This is
yes. I think he does hunger. Well, he's still writing educational.
Right.
That's a
like,
change that Alden Robinson made, is he's writing educational things for kids. So he wants
yeah,
to
this is
be
like,
a part of the world, not like Salinger, who didn't write anything after 1965.
Right. This is the human.
It.
Yeah. It's the human condition that we need each other in some way, yep. and that we do need connection. And the version of the story of like, I'm J.D. Salinger and I'm really just happy alone on my mountain. Really? Like, you can, yeah. You say that.
Or I guess, but you could be, but if you are, you're not entering the story in this way.
Right, right.
Yeah, you just aren't. And also that James Earl Jones is black adds a valence to Terrence Mann that Salinger doesn't have, especially as a political figure, mm-hmm. where the Boat Rocker sounds like a more overtly political work, even because it's just by a black person, than Catcher in the Rye ever was. And the world is dangerous for right. Terrence Mann in a way it's not for mm-hmm. J.D. Salinger. Like, we don't really hear when Mann goes into his cocoon, but it's probably late 60s. Bobby's dead. Malcolm's yep. dead. Martin's dead. Terrence Mann is going to be assassinated if you're looking at, you know, if you're reading the tea leaves or you're looking at the pattern. So there's a very way in which the world is connection on the level he's used to it as a public intellectual, political, literary figure is impossible. It's too mm-hmm. dangerous. So what the field provides him is a safe space
yeah,
to do Terrence Mann things without being shot by some racist in Birmingham, Alabama,
right.
or in Boston or wherever he
and
is.
I think the PTA meeting serves to show us that if yeah. you're willing to read the movie in that way, that they're having this PTA meeting about banning books, and one of the books they want to ban is Terrence right. Mann's Boat Rocker. And the response to the book is not just the overwhelming people from the 60s like Ray, who love the book mm-hmm. and deeply connected to it and found it to be formative, but people who have been now in 1989, I guess, having negative reactions to it for almost 30 years and want to ban it and, you know, wave their power around. And what kind of experiences a Black writer who's doing political work is going to have out just in public life at the hands of those people, those PTA people just out loose in the world coming for you is not a thing. I mean, we still have them in 2021 and you can take them back anytime, please. But that's just not an experience that a writer wants to have or will feel safe having. And you need a degree, I think a pretty high degree of psychological safety, not just physical safety, to feel like you can access openness to connection and to wonder and to reanalyzing relationships and having any kind of reparative experience like these characters are having.
Yeah. Let's take another sponsor break. Then we're going to talk about the genius of Phil Alden Robinson rather than focusing on the weaknesses of the book, but sort of show what Robinson does, talk about some of the things he did as a way of talking about the book too, after the break here.
Today's episode is brought to you by Scribner. Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman is a collection of seven stories in which characters pursue their obsessions on paths to glory and destruction, while all around them their worlds twist and warp, oscillating between reality and impossibility. On display throughout is Cotman's ability to reveal truths about the human experience, about things like friendship, love, betrayal, bitterness, all through whimsy, horror, and fantasy. Elegiac in tone, imaginative, and humorous in their execution, the character-driven stories in Weird Black Girls challenge, incite, and entertain. The author's last book was named one of NPR's Best Books of the Year and was a finalist for the Philip K. Dick Award, with reviews appearing in the New York Times, Wired, BuzzFeed, and Locus, among other publications. Definitely make sure to check out Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman. And thanks again to Scribner for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
When I told Michelle that Ray starts asking about his father playing with them from this jump when Shoeless Joe there, I don't think outrage is too strong of a term to describe her reaction to that. She says it ruins the whole thing. Uh-huh. It takes away a lot of the magic. It takes away the selflessness of Ray, that you don't get his selfishness till the end, or at least self-interest. When he says, well, what's in it for me till the very end? And then it doesn't do... We didn't have term for it there, but the M. Night Shyamalan thing of everything makes sense that you didn't really understood still needed some wrapping around. Like, it's the I See Dead People and Bruce Willis is also dead. It's like, oh, this is also about all these people, but also about Ray's father and Ray himself. It's about everybody. All of these messages are about everybody himself. Much more up front of mind. He asks about the catcher he's expecting the whole time. Totally changed it.
It does.
Robinson realizes to withhold that Ray doesn't even know yet, right? That's the thing about therapy, is like, you don't even sometimes know the thing you're mad about. Like, think of the field as a kind of therapy is an interesting metaphor in its own kind of what it does and doesn't do for you. Cutting out the sort of the fourth horseman in Eddie, this liar wannabe looking for some way to be somebody, but lies about being a former baseball player. Of the things that people would be shocked to hear, I texted this to you. I have to say this out loud. I don't know what to do about it. I think the best and highest example of the stuff that's in here that you don't want is that Ray in the book has a twin brother named Richard, who is a carnival worker whose wife's name is Gypsy, a little on the nose, WP. And there is a scene that's conveyed in which Ray and his twin brother as teenagers
talk about this.
Take off their pants to measure their erections to compare the size of their boners together. That is a real thing that happens in this book upon which Field of Dreams is based on.
My soul has left my body, Jeff.
This is all to say, this is the shining example of the concision, and there's not wholesale changes that Robinson made. He moved some things around. I think he was given a little gift by making it basically, it sounds like impossible to make this Salinger from all practical points of view. So he doesn't have to do any of the stuff that there works. He cuts out, when Ray goes to Salinger to go find him, he makes a tour of ballparks. And there's a little light racism in there,
yeah,
I think.
There's some pretty,
you know, in some places.
There's a pretty yikes moment of crossing the street when black people are out in, I think he's in Chicago at that.
In the South Side going to see the White Sox.
Yeah, it's pretty yikes.
It's not what you want. And then the one, so really the two signal ones though are cutting out the stuff you don't need. And I'm going to include dick measuring as part of that. Just writ large.
We just to be clear.
Just to be clear. I wouldn't consider myself an award-winning screenwriter, but I would have left that on the floor too. Is changing that you don't know that the he pain eases pain. The he pronouns are really about John Kinsella towards the end, and that Ray isn't really considering that his dad could come back. Because it makes more sense that he doesn't think of his dad on the level of Shoeless Joe Jackson and Major League Baseball players. Like, this is something else. I think the other important one, too, is the book ends with Salinger's, very similar to what Terrence Mann does, sort of going into the rapture of Salinger's rapture. That happens before John meets his dad, or in the mm-hmm. movie, and the ending scene is him meeting his father, and it's not the "Hey, Dad, you want to have a catch?" It's just not in the book. And the other thing I think this movie is about, in addition to being fathers and sons, I'd be curious to hear about this, is one of my desires, I think one of many people's desires, is to be seen and heard and felt without having to explain yourself. Without mm-hmm. having to go to do the hard work of working through your issues, of working through what your communication problems are, always wanting to feel like you have an organic emotional connection with psychological safety with the people you care about. That's something we want. We can get those things, but we usually work hard on it, and usually become vulnerable. It can be very difficult. The genius of "Hey, Dad, you want to have a catch?" is that it gets to say everything you want. Mm-hmm. It's just a pure metaphor of just unarticulated, unsaid, but wholly, I guess, affirming connection, right? Because mm-hmm. Costner's own metaphor at the beginning is, can you imagine a kid saying no to his dad about having a catch? It's a most elemental kind of rebuke, right? And then by contrast, the saying yes is the most elemental kind of affirmation. Yes, I will. And us doing this thing together, it has no meaning besides that we are doing it together and we are connecting without all of the stuff that typically, quote unquote, men don't talk about their feeling stuff. Mm-hmm. But what I think when we say that is they don't want to, because they want the thing underneath it without having to be vulnerable and exposed and blah, blah, blah. They want the, yes, I'll have a catch. Everything is okay. You're okay. I understand you and you understand me. Mm-hmm. And that's all that there is. So what do you take? Anything there for you, Rebecca? Do you like that? What do you want to say about
that? I like that. I think that's true. And that there are, I think that men's reactions, especially to that final scene, like there's not a man in my life that you can say, "Hey, Dad, want to have a catch," to, who can get through the sentence without tearing up.
Like, I can't even say the word "catch" in other circumstances like, now without like a little verklempen.
Yeah, I was watching this on Monday afternoon, and Bob was working from home and had been hanging out with me, and we got near this point, and he was like, "I got to leave the room because I still have to get work done today." And I was like, "Okay, bud, you know, see you later." But it is such an elemental thing that, and it sounds, I think one of the things that you just said was like, you know, there's, all you're asking for is being in this moment, and that we don't have to have the big talk and we don't have to do the big thing. We're just in this moment together. And I think that we want that because those moments are really all we need. Like if right. if we could yes. just connect, if we didn't, I don't know if we didn't have society, like if we could just,
we didn't have to judge each other.
Right.
We didn't if have we didn't to worry have, about other people judging us. Am right. I living up to my if, father's right. expectation? If we didn't is he living have, up to mine?
And this is a much bigger like piece of criticism, or a bigger piece of framing than I think W.P. Kinsella would be interested right. in. But like, if we didn't have capitalism and patriarchy and toxic masculinity, mm. we could maybe just have these pure connections with each other that are just about seeing and connecting. And it's all the experiences and the way that the world kind of screws you up that require all the talking and all the work and right. all the dissecting and figuring out my pattern and figuring out your pattern and all those pieces. And it is a beautiful dream to just be yeah. able to see someone else and have them see you and feel understood in that moment. And I think it's important that Ray gets to have that because he's already in the like he's done this work. He has built the yeah. field. He's,
it's the payoff. Right.
Right.
It's,
yeah. It's he's the done payoff, the work. Right. He's built the field. He has been open to this mystery. He has opened to reconsidering who his father was and what his father's life was about and therefore what his own mm-hmm. life was about. And it's that like it's the fact that Ray can see his dad that lets his dad see him back, and yeah. that's I think that's why it's or one of the reasons that bit is so powerful on so many levels. But I think that's really mm-hmm. what's turning there is Ray did all of this work himself. Like he gets to have that whole moment because of how he has transformed.
Yeah, it's interesting because no, I mean, Terrence Mann has to do a little bit of, I mean, Terrence Mann work is a leap of faith, right? To join Ray to the ball field. And then it's affirmed when, once you get to see the magic, you are pulled along by it, mm-hmm. right? But then what's left over to do for Ray is to sort of wrap his head around like what yeah. this actually means. And it's this simple little thing and everything else is just gets in the way, mm-hmm. Gets in the way of that. One last sponsor break and maybe we'll pick some nits or open questions or anything else we might have here at the end. Question for you. Is The Boat Rocker by Terrence Mann your number one draft pick of fictitious books you would read if they came out tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay, that's simple. That was easy. I can't even think of something else. There's like a bunch of like books in Wes Anderson and like, you know, you could do a bunch of different
yeah,
things.
Well, and there's like The Shadow of the Wind inside The Shadow of the Wind.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting one too. That's a good one too.
But I mean, it is. And not for nothing, Amy Madigan is formative for me also. Like,
oh, talk about this.
The very fiery, because we didn't, especially in 1989, yeah. there and like through the 90s, and too many characters still today, like the wife is often just naggy, or, you mm-hmm. know, the wife is just shrill, or she's a doormat, and that Annie gets to have this perspective. She gets to be sharp and funny. You know, she gets to halt the spread of neo-fascism by defending a book. Like the PTA book burning scene is like one of my key connections to this movie. Mm. And I was so surprised.
And still sadly relevant to right? what we talk about week in and like, week out.
Right. These PTA meetings are still happening about some of the yeah. same books that they're talking right. about in this movie. But it's so important. Her character is so important to me. And that, like, that sparkle of, like, they have this relationship with each other that's so affectionate, but it's not soft. It's not just purely mm-hmm. soft. And I think that there's just something that I relate to there, or that I aspire to, or maybe all of the above of like, I'll be in your corner, but I'm going to call you on your shit too. Right, and yeah. I think that's part of being a good teammate or a good partner. And she just does it so well that, yeah, I'm.
Yeah. That difference between being supportive and being a yes man or yes woman is actually not very well articulated or,
yeah.
you know, and, demonstrated a lot.
Right.
Of
and she's got it. And so I think also as a younger person, especially, I would definitely have wanted to read The Boat Rocker by Terrence Mann because I would want to figure out how to be like Annie. Hmm.
Could we also talk about the economics of corn farming in Iowa?
It's a rough go from
so
what I've heard.
So a baseball field is about 4 acres. So with 4 acres was enough to tip them over? Like what actually happened with the Kinsella balance sheet? Mm. I'm still unclear about what happened here. Clearly, did they take out a loan to Why are they having money trouble? Is it that 4 acres of corn really was a difference between them making their payment or not? Like, I'm not sure. Again, it just doesn't matter. Don't think about it this much.
Yeah, don't think about it.
It feels true. If you don't think about it, it feels true. But if, this is what I'm saying. If you actually go one step, if you step off in any direction, it's chaos and sadness and pain. So well, don't do it. But let me just show you where a couple of the places are. So that's one. Like I said before, that line of 400 people or 400 cars immediately ruins it. It upends world religions. There are riots. Ghosts are real. There's an afterlife.
Oh my gosh.
Where's my grandma?
Where's my grandma?
It's a horror show. This place is burnt to the ground within 72 hours.
Yeah, not to mention the people who pay for it, but who can't see the baseball players, and then they have to get told it's because you're dead inside.
Someone almost has to die in front of them. So there's like a whole industry of like near-death experiences to enact your vision to see here. It's a complete mess. It's a complete mess. Another one, I hate to say this.
Oh, no.
It's not bad, but does Ray Liotta give us anything here?
No, and Ray Liotta is... It's not a great performance. And then I have come to know, like, his mom had just died when they filmed.
It's a tough moment for Ray.
He hasn't watched it after? Yeah, he's never watched it. It's a hard moment. Yeah. There are a couple moments where he has, like, a little wink in his eye that comes across. But it's pretty flat. Like, Shoeless Joe... And I guess it could have gone the other way. Like, someone playing Shoeless Joe could have dialed it up too much. Oh, and that's one thing I just don't want to get through talking about the movie without mentioning is this, like, the little bits of humor that Robinson writes in using the banter between the ball players is just, they're wonderful. You know, it's just really fun to watch. There's so much extra flavor in that.
Is Shoeless Joe and the Chicago Black Sox, the eight who took money from Arnold Rothstein to throw the 1919 World Series, is that really on the par with Terrence Mann maybe being assassinated for writing a book that, you know, uplifts people that are oppressed? Like, Shoeless Joe took the money. He took the money to throw the World Series, and the book and the movie try to do their best to present this as some great injustice that he was. You know what? If you take money from a gambler and say you're going to throw the World Series, I'm not Mr. Law and Order here, but I think you don't get to play baseball anymore.
I agree.
Is that wrong?
No.
So it's like, you can't think about that too much. You can't think about it too
much. Yeah, what are we trying to like seek justice for here, I mean, for these guys?
That's why I think it's made differently today. It is Negro Leagues. Or it's, you know, League of Their Own is maybe a different movie if it's like the women's players that are coming back and, you know, getting to fill their dreams. That's another very interesting one. Also, this is one that Michelle that brought up, that our Midwestern roots really called this out. There's a scene when Ray is building the field, and like some of the local yokels start like camping out to watch him do it. This would never happen in a million years.
No, they would all be driving by and then like standing at the store talking to each other about it.
Or they'd be working. They're all farmers. They don't have time to sit around and watch them do the thing. So that one blew me away too. Did you need the lights? Why did the, what is the, you don't need, the ghost tells him you have to have the lights because you see the vision, you sort of believe there, and this is done better in the movie too, where it's like you get to see it. But like, then in the book, Ray has to wait 3 years for Shoeless Joe to show.
Yeah.
In the movie, we're not sure how long it is, but it's at least one season because we see a shot of like the snow. Mm-hmm. So we've gone from summer, a full year. What are we sweating? What are we sweating Ray out here? Like, what is this penance? Is this purgatory? Like, why didn't Shoeless Joe show up the first day? He did the thing. It didn't say build it and then wait 3 years and he will come. Like, what's going on there? Like had the ghost magic not kicked in and he's to cycle up? You need to let it prove overnight and double in size? Like, I don't get, what are we doing to Ray here? That seems unnecessary.
It does seem unnecessary. I was just so relieved that it wasn't the 3 years from the book.
It feels like they're tortured. It's this torture.
1 year is just long enough for a good montage, and this movie makes use of good montages a couple times.
It is the best one. My favorite one is when he's building the field, telling Karen about Shoeless Joe with the voiceover and all the stuff that's going on, how Shoeless Joe is a crook and shouldn't be allowed back in. But that's my take on it too. So again, you can't wander. Also, Mark is portrayed as the villain, but he's looking out for the Kinsellas. They build a ball field. There's about the default. We hate Mark, and yet Timothy Busfield's just looking out for his family. He's like, you get to keep the house. That's the only reason. But it's an extremely tough look for Busfield here. did him dirty. I don't like it.
Oh, I do not share that sympathy. I was like, I've yearned for a flipped perspective version of this from Annie's point of view forever. I don't think we need to give Mark any.
But look at it from Timothy. But he's got his beard. He's very serious. That's how you know.
Doesn't he have suspenders at one point? Like you really, basically, you really.
If
do
you don't remember, you're probably too young to remember, but. Timothy Busfield he's a bigger star at this moment for being one of the leads on 30 Something, which is a giant TV show about being adults. And he plays a dick, good businessman who's a dick. So I think they just like said, you know what? Can you just do the same thing over here? And they made him for 30 Something grow that beard to make him look more serious. And now it's like a Busfield signature to have the red beard. And we see him in Danny Kincannon later. Mm-hmm. But like Mark, what he's looking at his family staring out like, he's like, these people are, this is a cult.
Well,
these are Branch Davidians out here. They're standing in the middle of the field just looking at blankness.
And there's,
I'd be calling psychiatric services if I was Mark.
There's a version of that too, but to go back to the reading of this as being about like connection and openness and wonder, he's gone so far into the side of practicality and let me tell you what's good for you. And like, really nothing is a nail in the coffin of connection faster than let me tell you what you need to do.
No. But if someone is actually self-destructive, there is a sort of sense of like, we got to take the keys from it. You're getting to drive drunk here. I can't let you do it. So that's also, so that scene when his mom or Annie's mom comes and the family, what have they told them about what they're doing there? Did they tell them that, by the way, you might see ghosts on our baseball field when you come over for brunch?
They
don't seem prepped at all.
They've definitely not told them that. I think they have assumed going in that there's no way in hell Annie's family is going to see these guys.
No, but they're the first ones that don't see it. They don't know that people can't see it before then. Until Mark shows up that first time. Like, what are they telling Mark? They say, we built this baseball field, and now we see ghosts, but we're not going to mention it to our family.
Well, since you like, don't know when the ghosts...
come over...
But the ghosts might not show up when they're there, so why prep them for a thing that...
No, but I'm saying, if we, just in case we're out there staring at these dudes, they're real. They're not like Civil War reenactors or something. Those are real ghosts you're seeing, so just so you know, that's all paid off.
Those are real ghosts.
The ghost strategy worked. Tim.
Oh my God.
It's all going according.
You can't go too far.
Let it just go, stay on the roller coaster rails. Enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
Don't look at the carnies. Don't look at the clowns putting on their makeup. Just enjoy the show.
you let yourself go to some places here.
This is what I do. Rebecca, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. We enjoy Field of Dreams very much. I can honestly say, all respects to Kinsella, who had a really interesting seed of an idea. And a lot of the pieces are there, and some of the most beautiful language makes it to the movie. I'm not even going to ask you in our question, do you save the book or do you save the movie? There's no contest. It's the film. So there we are. Field of Dreams. Check it out. Watch it on a summer's eve. And then go play catch with your daughter or son or whatever else you're going to do. Whatever catch is for you. We'll talk to you next time.
Have a good one.
People will come, Ray. They'll come to Iowa for reasons they can't even fathom. They'll turn up your driveway, not knowing for sure why they're doing it. They'll arrive at your door as innocent as children, longing for the past. Of course, we won't mind if you look around, you'll say. It's only $20 per person. They'll pass over the money without even thinking about it. For it is money they have and peace they like.
Ray. Just sign the papers.
And they'll walk out to the bleachers. Sit in shirt sleeves on a perfect afternoon. They'll find they have reserved seats somewhere along one of the baselines. Where they sat when they were children and cheered their heroes. And they'll watch the game. And it'll be as if they'd dipped themselves in magic waters. The memories will be so thick, they'll have to brush them away from their faces.